took him to a private house in another jurisdiction. I mean, you wouldn't believe it if you saw it in a movie, but I'm imagining it'll be that one day. But you know, in Mississippi, I got to say this. We have a Department of Justice Civil Rights Division that is headed by a black woman, and Christian Clark takes her job seriously, and her Southern Division attorneys have pursued and made history in this area. And Judge Thomas Lee, they thought that Judge Thomas Lee down here in Mississippi would not do justice, and oh, how he has set a standard and put police officers on notice all over America that if you do the crime, you're going to do the time, just like anybody else.
Well, I just want to say, Eddie Terrell Parker, you and Michael Corey Jenkins, amazingly brave in coming forward and describing what happened to you, which seems to have broken open all of these investigations right now. I want to thank civil rights attorney Malik Shabazz and Trent Walker with Black Lawyers for Justice, and Eddie Parker, who was tortured by the Goon Squad. Thank you so much joining us from Jackson, Mississippi. And that does it for our show. Very happy belated birthday to Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's folk music programs.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of the programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an independent analysis finds Oregon's police deadly force database has missing and incorrect data.
Salem Kaiser unionized teachers vote to approve a strike.
And in national news, advocates push Congress to restore Clean Water Act protections for small streams and wetlands.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. Police killings in Oregon may not be documented properly by Oregon officials. Portland Cop Watch released a report on Monday with findings from their project tracking deadly force incidents which involved law enforcement in the state of Oregon. The report found 74 cases in which a police killing was not entered into the database at all. It found an additional 56 cases on the books that included errors like misspelled names, incorrect dates, and inadequate information around the race of the victims. The findings were sent to Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum. Of the 74 deaths that were missing entirely in the state's data, 9 were missing from Multnomah County, representing 19% of the county's 47 deaths since 2010. The existence of the state's deadly forest database is a result of SB 111. That's the 2007 bill that established procedures for law enforcement agencies and district attorneys to follow when dealing with the use of deadly physical force. It also sets out rules for grand jury proceedings in which use of deadly physical force was an element. KABU reached out to the Attorney General's office and the Multnomah County District Attorney's office, but we have not heard back as of airtime.
KABU reporters Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moss have more on this story.
Portland Cop Watch has been tracking deadly force incidents in Oregon since 2010 and comparing their findings to what has been entered in the state's deadly force database. They use media reports, press releases, and other national projects that track police violence for their data. They found 74 cases where a person who was killed by police was not included in the database at all, as well as 56 cases that included erroneous data.
We spoke today with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. Handelman detailed some of the cases that are missing or including incorrect data. Some of them are very well known and have resulted in litigation, large settlements, or ongoing activism.
Some of the cases that are missing are particularly high-profile cases, like Stacey Kenney, a transgender woman who was killed in her car in Springfield. That was led to one of the, if not the highest, settlement for police violence in the state's history. And it's, Lane County hasn't reported that yet. Christopher Kalonji, who is was killed by Clackamas County Sheriff's deputies, and people in Portland might recognize his name because his mother is very active in the Pacific Northwest Family Circle, was a young black man, and his race is listed as white.
SB 111 does not actually require law enforcement agencies to report all instances of deadly force.
It's important to note that the law only covers when somebody dies. Now, Portland Cop Watch has been tracking every kind of deadly force incident in the state that we can find since 2010, and there are a lot more cases where police shot at somebody or shot and wounded them than just the incidents we're talking about today, which are the ones where people died.
Even if the state's data set was complete in terms of the requirements of SB 111, it still would not reflect the full scale of police killings in the state.
The police terminology for tasers and similar weapons is a less lethal device. So they think that it's not deadly, but it's called less lethal and not non-lethal because it can kill. So we would argue that the taser-caused death should be in there at this point. I think there's only one taser-caused death that's in the database. It's a very serious thing that we have people who are working for the government paid for by our tax money, that have the ability to take people's lives away. So we're hoping that they look at all these cases.
Since the report went out on Monday, 5 of the 74 missing cases have been entered into the DOJ's database.
It actually is sort of encouraging for us as an organization that does a lot of advocacy and education around things, and we hardly ever see anything change, to see that people actually responded to what we did.
Handelman goes on to say that there is still more to be done to ensure that implementation matches intention.
I think it would be good for the Attorney General to revisit the statute and work through the details of who's responsible to make sure these things are posted.
And urged concerned listeners to make their voices heard.
If they're also concerned, I think they should get in touch with the Attorney General and if they are living in Multnomah County or any county where KABU reaches and they want to reach out to their local DA, especially if their DA is mentioned or their county is mentioned in here as not fulfilling the reporting requirements, that might be worthwhile as well.
You can read Portland Cop Watch's letter to Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and view their complete data on their website at portlandcopwatch.org.
The Department of Justice database is also public and viewable on the Attorney General's website, but it is still a little difficult to find. So here is the full URL. Grab your pencil. justice.oregon.gov/death-incident, all one word, /home/search. Thank you to Dan Handelman for speaking with KABU today. For the evening news, I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine.
Salem Kaiser teachers voted to authorize a strike today. More than 94% of voting members in the union voted in favor of strike authorization, and more than 99% of members in the union cast a vote. Tyler Skello Lakeberg, the president of the Salem Kaiser Teachers Union, says the teachers do not want to go on strike, but will do so in order to negotiate a better contract. The biggest issue in contract negotiations is over teacher workload. Union leadership says the school district's proposal could reduce some full-time educators to part-time. There are also concerns about class size and about teacher raises, which will likely be around 10% over the next 2 years. The Salem Kaiser School District is currently facing a $30 million budget shortage. Superintendent Andrea Castaneda says that due to these budget restraints, the school district cannot meet the union's demands. Skella Lakeberg says that if teachers do strike, it could happen in the first or second weeks of April. If the Salem Kaiser teachers do strike, it would mean teachers in Oregon's two largest school districts went on strike in the same school year, as Portland teachers were on strike for a month back in November. After bargaining on March 20th, there was positive movement, and the two sides will continue to negotiate on Monday.
Three of Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's top advisors are either leaving her office or going on leave. That's according to an announcement out today. Chief of Staff Andrea Cooper will leave March 29th. Cooper was the Deputy Chief of Staff for former Governor Kate Brown. Kotek said of her, quote, "I thank Andrea for bringing her experience to help lead my office during a whirlwind transition in the first year of my administration. We have all accomplished significant things for Oregonians, and she was instrumental in establishing a strong team of professionals. I wish her well in her future endeavors," end quote. Kotek Special Advisor Abby Tibbs is leaving at the end of the month, too. She'll be returning to her positions at OHSU. Deputy Chief of Staff for Public Engagement Lindsay O'Brien is going on leave starting April 5th, and it's unclear when she will return. O'Brien has worked with Kotek since 2015, when Kotek was State House Speaker. OPB reports that the news of the staff shakeup in the governor's office was met with surprise across the Oregon political world.
The future of the Rose Quarter expansion of I-5 is uncertain, even though the project got a major federal funding boost this month. On March 8th, the Oregon Department of Transportation received $450 million from the federal government for the Rose Quarter caps over I-5. It's part of the U.S. Department of Transportation's Reconnecting Communities pilot program. ODOT also wants to widen I-5 at the Rose Quarter with extra lanes and shoulders. The State Transportation Department actually got only half the funds they requested, leaving the project with a $1.6 billion gap in funding. The grant is supposed to help Portland reconnect and rebuild Lower Albina, a historically black neighborhood that was bisected by the construction of I-5 in the 1960s. Opponents of freeway expansion say that these new lanes will create higher demand for driving and increase carbon emissions in a community already experiencing displacement and pollution. The Rose Quarter expansion project wouldn't be moving forward without the support of the Albina Vision Trust, or AVT, a nonprofit with plans to restore the historically black inner northeast Portland neighborhood. AVT Executive Director Winta Johannes called the federal grant a, quote, "catalytic federal investment that represents the beginning of a new chapter, one where government plays an active role in not only healing the harms of history, but investing in community-driven visions of a better tomorrow," end quote. On March 12th, ODOT announced that the Federal Highway Administration approved the project to go forward after performing an environmental analysis. But environmental advocacy groups like No More Freeways demand that ODOT conduct a thorough environmental impact statement to consider building freeway caps without the extra lanes. The group wrote, "Adding extra lanes to I-5 will have a significant environmental impact on the Albina community, creating more traffic and carbon emissions in the neighborhood and the planet. With the funding shortfalls and the debates around the ODOT plans for the project, the future of the Rose Quarter I-5 project is uncertain."
Today is World Water Day, a global observance to raise awareness about the importance to access clean, fresh, and safe water. This year, advocates in the U.S. are urging Congress to restore protections under the Clean Water Act for smaller streams and wetlands, which were overturned in a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last year. Jim Murphy is with the National Wildlife Federation. He says rivers and streams that are used for swimming and fishing flow into larger bodies of water, so it's essential for that water to be safeguarded.
It's really important for people to ensure that with the rollbacks from the Supreme Court, that they're ensuring that their state and local leaders are doing what they can to protect the waters that people rely on.
A bill in Congress, the Clean Water Act of 2023, would reinstate the rule that the Supreme Court struck down and broaden the definition of which streams and waterways are subject to federal protection. It has more than 120 co-sponsors, but remains stalled in the U.S. House. Murray points to a poll that found that more than 90% of Americans think protecting the safety of drinking water and the water in lakes, streams, and rivers should be a priority. He adds the most effective and cost-efficient approach to safeguarding water is to protect it before it gets to your home faucet.
Protecting water at its source is the most important and one of the cheapest things we can do to ensure that people who are facing a crisis of dirty water are protected. But in other cases, we also have to invest in the right type of infrastructure to make sure that water is clean.
That was Jim Murphy, Senior Director of Legal Advocacy at the National Wildlife Federation.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy, with an overnight low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be overcast, with a 50% chance of rain and a high of 58. Today in history, in 1972, the Supreme Court decides the case Eisenstadt v. Baird. The court held that unmarried people have a right to possess contraceptives, because banning the distribution of contraceptives to unmarried people violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The quote of the day is from French mime artist Marcel Marceau, born this day in 1923. He expressed, "To communicate through silence is a link between the thoughts of man."
Release me from the chamber.
California voters narrowly approve a proposition to address homelessness and mental health, and GOP-led states file legislation mirroring a controversial Texas immigration law. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If it were you, or if it were your family member who was on the streets, ill, suffering from mental illness or addiction, you would want a solution to this epidemic.
James Espinoza with the Veteran Mentor Project thanks the California voters who narrowly approved Proposition 1, a multi-billion dollar effort to update mental health funding and tackle chronic homelessness. Prop 1 will build housing and expand behavioral health and drug treatment. Governor Gavin Newsom calls it a huge victory for an approach that's radically different. The U.S. Justice Department and 16 states have filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple, charging it with monopolizing smartphone sales. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco says Apple uses its market power to dominate development of apps and devices and has smothered an entire industry.
Locking its customers in to the iPhone while locking its competitors out of the market.
Monaco says the lawsuit seeks to stop Apple from undermining software that competes with its own apps in streaming, messaging, and digital payments. A controversial Texas law allowing state and local officials to arrest and deport people suspected of illegally crossing the border remains tied up in courts. But at least 7 GOP-led states are looking at similar measures. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds says the Biden administration has failed to enforce immigration laws, forcing states to step in.
Every state is a border state, and Iowa is no exception. The effects that Texas has been experiencing for 3 years are now a reality here at home.
Reynolds says she'll sign a bill allowing police to arrest undocumented immigrants and better protect the public. But Marshalltown, Iowa Police Chief Michael Tupper says forcing migrants and minorities into the shadows will only make his job harder.
If we don't have people that are willing to help us, call us, cooperate with us, If they're now hiding from us, it's going to make it very difficult to do our job.
Meanwhile, several Democratic senators are sponsoring federal legislation to let immigration and customs officials get arrest warrants for undocumented immigrants who've been charged with violent crimes. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A controversial proposal to build a maze of pipelines in several Midwestern states to transport carbon dioxide and store it underground is still in play. Regulatory issues and legal challenges have complicated the project, and pipeline opponents hope concerned residents are keeping up with the latest developments. Mike Moen reports.
New public hearings and legal decisions are expected in the coming weeks and months about a controversial pipeline project in the upper Midwest. The company behind the effort appears ready for the long haul, but so are its opponents. Summit Carbon Solutions has been seeking permits and trying to acquire land in multiple states, including North Dakota, for a maze of pipelines it wants to build. Those pipes would carry ethanol plant emissions and store them underground. Attorney Brian Jordy represents property owners challenging the project. Despite some regulatory setbacks, he says it's clear the company is still forging ahead.
Every state is still in play. There's nothing different from a year ago than right now.
This week, Jordy made arguments before the South Dakota Supreme Court in a complex element of the case tied to landowners' rights. And North Dakota regulators are formalizing plans for public hearings for Summit's new permit application after saying no last year. Summit says the initiative has environmental and economic benefits. However, opponents worry about safety issues and are skeptical of the carbon sequestration claims. Like North Dakota, South Dakota regulators last year rejected Summit's initial permit application, and these actions have pushed back the project's timeline. Jordy hopes the public doesn't lose interest in these developments, especially residents concerned about pipelines running through their property.
If you don't speak up, the assumption is you don't mind, and you won't have a voice.
The latest North Dakota public hearings could begin as early as this spring, and Jordy says it could take several months for a decision on the South Dakota legal case, and Summit is expected to try again for permit approval there. Other states connected to the project include Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
Disparities in maternal health care for Native Americans in South Dakota is the focus of new research. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Researchers are working to understand factors underlying maternal health care for Native women in western South Dakota. Most counties west of the Missouri River are considered a maternal health care desert. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports, that means women live more than 100 miles away from medical providers that specialize in delivery.
Distance, weather, transportation, and trauma are just a few of the barriers standing in the way of pregnant Native American women needing or wanting prenatal health care. That's coupled with a lack of providers West River, both in reservations and in the Black Hills. Dr. Amy Elliott is a chief research officer at Avera McKinnon. She describes the issue bluntly.
It's crisis levels with the lack of obstetrics providers, especially on the western side of the state. And how do we find solutions, not just for recruiting more people, but also do we have to think a little bit different about how we deliver care?
According to the South Dakota Department of Health, from 2012 to 2021, American Indians made up 20% of all live births, but 44% of all pregnancy-associated deaths. Elliott and others want to fully understand what's causing that issue and others. Elliott says a lack of data hinders insight into understanding causes or generating solutions.
An advantage of being within a health system is we have access to quite a bit of data, and we also have close partnerships with the Department of Health, with Great Plains Tribal Leaders Board, and other community agencies around. And so we're able to help maybe combine some different data streams that haven't been combined before.
That, Elliott hopes, will lead to lasting and systemic change in better health outcomes for Native women on the Great Plains. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
A new documentary spotlights the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and the tribe's David versus Goliath battle against the Line 5 pipeline. The film started screening in select theaters last week. Lena Tran of WUWM in Milwaukee has more.
The Bad River Band is up against the Canadian energy company Enbridge. 12 miles of pipeline runs through the Bad River Reservation. It's a fight the band says is necessary to defend Lake Superior from the aging pipeline and protect the lake for future generations. Running Horse Livingston is a Bad River member featured in the film.
We're fighting this battle for water, but it's really a battle for our home and keeping it safe and keeping it beautiful the way that it has been for forever.
The film says there's no evidence the band ever consented to the pipeline. A federal judge ruled that Enbridge is trespassing and has 3 years to shut it down. The film argues this is only the latest chapter in the tribe's long fight for sovereignty. Here's producer, writer, and director Mary Mazzio.
And, you know, long after this challenge, there will be another one, because that's just the history of who we are as a country. This is a very, very precarious situation happening in real time.
Erosion near the banks of the Bad River has stoked the band's concerns that the exposed pipeline could rupture. Their urgency grows as climate change makes extreme rainfall and flooding more and more likely. For National Native News, I'm Lena Tran in Milwaukee.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the Kiowa Tribe in Oklahoma are hosting a Veterans Benefits event on April 5th. Tribal Veterans Service officers and other advocates are expected to be on site at the tribe's community center to assist veterans, spouses, and widows with VA claims. According to the VA, collaborations with other tribes across the country are in the works to hold similar events. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
During the war in Gaza, university campuses have become hotspots for protests and demonstrations. But as universities and state officials ban pro-Palestinian groups from organizing, some voices are rising against what they perceive as a stifling of freedom of expression and healthy debate on campus. Tramiel Gomes reports on the fallout in Florida.
As the Israel-Hamas conflict continues, students find it hard to freely express opinions as universities shut down groups due to political tensions and accusations of anti-Semitism. Florida State University undergrad John Ocampo was part of Students for Justice in Palestine on campus, which no longer exists. He explains they faced challenges even before Governor Ron DeSantis and the state system got involved. He says the group wasn't registered due to students being doxxed on sites that target people seen as anti-Israel or anti-Jewish.
My email has been hacked, my Cash App, my WhatsApp, everything. So that's what really discouraged people from continuing this, because our personal social medias, our personal lives, and even our bank accounts are all at risk.
Ocampo notes students pushing for peace or advocating for a ceasefire were unfairly labeled as anti-Semitic. He highlights the case of Students for a Democratic Society, suspended after members chanted pro-Palestinian slogans at a Board of Trustees meeting in November. The university said it supports rigorous debate and assembly, but students may not disrupt university business. Will Hanley, who teaches at Florida State, says the clampdown affects both student organizations and his teaching of Middle Eastern history.
I feel really restricted in what I can do. I certainly don't feel like I can organize talks or discussions where students will feel safe exploring ideas.
Hanley urges state education officials to foster environments where students can freely debate, make mistakes, and engage in learning from diverse perspectives, regardless of agreement. This week, University of South Florida students launched a hunger strike to protest the school's alleged investment in pro-Israel companies, a claim the university denies. Initially planned by Students for Socialism, the effort faced a cease and desist letter from university officials, so students came together with no affiliation to any campus group to hold the strike. John Ocampo says it's challenging to organize this way.
There's no set meeting space. The places that you're at are not ideal. And it doesn't seem like it's a huge deal, but it really starts to fracture the organizing over time.
Students for Justice in Palestine on two Florida campuses have filed lawsuits after their closure. However, a federal judge denied injunctions on First Amendment grounds, stating students hadn't demonstrated chilled speech or imminent punishment. The legal challenges are ongoing. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Colorectal cancer is the third most common form of cancer and the second most lethal form in the world. Dr. Margaret Chin with Kaiser Permanente in Lynnwood, Washington, says the number of younger Americans with advanced stages of colorectal cancer has gone up in recent decades. That's prompted the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force to lower its recommended screening age from 50 to 45.
This is surprising to a lot of us, but the statistics have shown this change from what we used to think is a disease for older people to now a disease for younger people.
Chin says the proportion of cases for people under 55 has nearly doubled over the last 25 years. However, she also notes the total number of colorectal cancer cases has actually declined, and that's likely due to better detection. Chin says there are options for how people can get screened. The traditional method is by colonoscopy, but a new method is the FIT kit test, which can be used at home. Chin says it's important to find the option that works best for each person.
The best screening test is the one that you will do. So I just want to encourage people that we cannot find cancer if we're not looking for it. So please talk to your provider about getting screened as soon as you can.
Colonoscopies are typically done every 10 years, while the FIT tests are taken every year. With FIT kits, doctors look for microscopic blood in stool samples. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Jasmine Moss, and Mattea Carlin. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, and Tramell Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philadelphia.